Welcome to Illinois Family Spotlight, a conversation about issues of the day from a biblical perspective, as well as highlights from interviews, conferences, and events.
Welcome back to another edition of Illinois Family Spotlight. My name is Jenna, and today we will be concluding our time with Dr. George Barna at our 2026 Illinois Family Institute Worldview Conference. Dr. Barna is a professor and director of research at Arizona Christian University, which, through that research, has led him to write many books, including the one he talked on at our Worldview Conference. That book is called Raising Spiritual Champions, Nurturing Your Child's Heart, Mind, and Soul. You can find that at the Illinois Family Institute resource store or at georgebarna.com. In the first half of Dr. Barna's lecture, which he titled Cultural Transformation Through Biblical Discipleship, he broke down why our country is headed down the wrong track culturally. In this episode, he shares our role as Christians on transforming our culture through that means of biblical discipleship.
So how do you do this disciple making? I'm in the process right now of finishing my last of several research projects for a book that I'm going to write over the summer on discipleship in America. And we've learned a lot of things that I think are pretty eye-opening. But let me just give you some simple stuff here related to this process. So as you're thinking about your life, and that's why you're here. You're not here to gather information. You're here to gather the impetus to go out and change the world, to allow God to use you as an agent of transformation. So how are you going to do that? You've got to make disciples. How do you make disciples? There are three things that happen in that process. First of all, it's based on relationships. You've got to get to know people who are not disciples. You've got to gain their trust. That's going to take time. It's going to take effort. Sometimes you're going to be confused by what it takes. It's okay. Stick with it. It is going to be confusing. Just know that. It's going to take a lot of your time. What does that mean? It means you may have to reassemble your schedule. How you spend your time may have to change. You look at the apostles. To me, it's so fascinating. All of these guys had jobs. They have full-time jobs. They became disciples, and suddenly their jobs were secondary. They'd fit them in when they could. They still had to feed the family. But first and foremost, they saw themselves as disciples. And so that's a shift that you're going to have to make. Your schedule is going to look different if you're serious about disciple-making. And part of it is going to be that you're going to have to get out into the world and share experiences with these people that you're going to be discipling. It doesn't happen in a classroom at a table. That's not where disciple-making happens. Disciple-making happens when you go out to a restaurant, you interact with the waitress. It happens when you go to a ball game and somebody spills their Coke on you. You know, I mean, all these different situations, who are you? Who are you? How do you operate in a Christ-like manner in real-life situations? That's where disciple-making happens. Secondly, this has to do with belief, worldview, right? Yeah, it's partly beliefs. The beliefs are critical because you do what you believe, so you're not going to become a disciple unless you can think like a disciple of Jesus. And so how do you get there? A lot of people ask me, gosh, how do I get into this whole worldview development thing? Well, it's through conversation. It's not through books. It's not through church services. It's through relationships where you have what I call Socratic dialogue. Socrates was known as a great teacher. Why? Because he never told his students what the right answer was. They'd come in for a discussion. He'd sit there and he'd say, today, I want to talk about whatever his topic was. And he'd point to one of his students. He'd say, well, what do you believe about that? And, you know, the person would say, well, I think that blah, blah, blah. Socrates would nod and said, okay, why do you think that? And there you go. The dialogue is now happening. They're going back and forth where he's asked the person, what do you believe? Why do you believe it? How did you come to that conclusion? Now, I know that you've experienced this other reality that seems to conflict with what you believe. What do you do with that? How do you put those things together? I mean, these are the kinds of conversations you want to have. See, and it's very easy in our culture today because with most people not buying biblical truth, those conversations are abundantly easy to find, very easy to have. And all you have to do is go out and do something, see what the person you're with is doing or thinking or saying, and asking them, wow, that's interesting. How'd you get there? You know, let's talk about that a little bit. And you slowly lead them back to biblical thinking, helping them to understand, well, here's God's truth. You are absolutely right if what you're trying to do is demonstrate the world's truth. But we live for a different purpose. We live for a different person. We live for a different outcome. And so to get there, we have to think differently. And let me talk to you about how we get there. So it's that Socratic dialogue that's so important in that process. Now, along the way, understand how Americans communicate. We love stories. One of the things that pastors do well often is they tell stories along with the biblical principles that they want us to grasp. That's a Christ-like principle. That's what Jesus did. He told stories all the time. And so the more that you can bring real-life stories from your life, your family's life, your friends' lives, into the conversation, into that Socratic dialogue, the better off you're going to be. And then finally, you want to have applications. You want to take that relationship, build that mindset, and then go out into the world and live it. And as you're doing that, accountability is a critical part of that. One of the mistakes that I see a lot of disciple makers make is that they do not invite the person they're discipling to hold them accountable. That's a critical thing. There's got to be that mutuality, that mutual accountability, where you've got to be willing to have the person you're mentoring call you on something. And one of the beauties of that I've learned personally is that sometimes they'll call me on something that wasn't sinful or unbiblical, but they think it is. And so that gives us another opportunity to talk about, oh, really? Well, let's talk about what the Bible really teaches there. Here's why I did that. Here's what I believe the Bible teaches. Here's the chapter and verse that, you know, gives you some of that background. What do you make of that? And then we get to continue that dialogue. And we reshape the behavior based on that. But it's that mutual accountability that is important. Modeling, all the research I've done so far indicates that the single most important aspect of discipling somebody is how you model the faith for them. First of all, they're not going to bother to have you disciple them if they watch you and they don't see you being Christ-like, because you're basically a fraud. So why would they want to be under your tutelage? So you've got to model that kind of a life for them. And then another critical thing that we're discovering too is that it's helpful to have ways of measuring what's going on. See, because if you don't have objective measures, what do you rely on? Feelings. And so we're back in that loop where now, you know, I feel pretty good about how I'm mentoring this person, as opposed to having some kind of objective measures where we're looking at what they think, what they believe, how they're living, who they're hanging out with, all those things. And of course, in the process of discipling people, both you and your mentee, your protege, whatever you want to call them, the person you're mentoring, have to be growing in your faith in the ways that we normally think of, whether it's reading the Bible, praying, worshiping God. All of those things are critically important to be going at all times. So, I mean, that's basically what it takes. So I'm going to end my time here with the fourth question, which in research I've come to realize over the years, everything I do in research has to adequately address one question, which is so what? So what? And I do this because when I first got started in research, I fell prey to clients who asked me to find all kinds of information for them that they thought would be really interesting. And it was. But ultimately, it was useless. We couldn't do anything with it. You know, I mean, we were Disney's main research firm for years. We did, you know, Visa, major corporations around the country. And what I found was that a number of those people wanted interesting things that they could bring into a board meeting or a group meeting, a director's meeting, whatever, and, you know, kind of wow the audience. But my perspective is, okay, we can only have so much time and money to gather information. It better be stuff that we can actually put into action. And so what are the action points coming out of this time together, the so what of all the stuff I've said? I'm going to give you 12 things that I want you to consider. I'm going to assume that you think of yourself as a disciple and therefore a disciple maker. And that as a disciple, you need to constantly be getting deeper in your relationship with Christ, better, more excellent in your process of discipling other people. And some of the things I'm going to suggest that you consider here will help you in that. I know that from the research we've been doing. So just consider these things. I'd love for you to do all 12 of these. I know you won't. But if you can pick out one or two of these at least that you say, yeah, you know, I really need to do that. I really should do that. That'd be great. And so number one, take a look at your calendar, at your schedule. How are you spending your time? Is it really organized around the notion that, not that, you know, I'm a vice president at my company, I'm a, you know, father in my family, I'm the leader in my community, I'm the coach on our baseball team. Is it organized around, I am a disciple of Jesus Christ, and my primary function on earth, the only reason God's keeping me here for another day is that I would go out and serve him, and the best way I can serve him is to raise up disciples in this culture. Does your calendar reflect that? Hopefully it does. Secondly, how do you know you have a biblical worldview? Do you have a biblical worldview? I know the moment I walk into almost every church in America, the answer is no, most of these people don't. They mean well, they're trying hard, but they're being misled, they're being overwhelmed by the world. There's all kinds of other stuff happening that's keeping them from being effective at that. So I mentioned earlier, we have this online evaluation system. You can take a look at your worldview. That's fine. But maybe there are other ones that you want to use. I don't care what you use. Use something that's reliable, and that's going to help you know if that's where you're at. Thirdly, how do you grow spiritually? Do you leave it up to yourself? Do you just hang out in small groups? Pastors almost always tell me, oh yeah, we have a very effective discipling process. You know, 80% of our congregations in small groups. Our research shows that small groups are abysmal at growing disciples. They're very good at making people feel like they're part of a community, making them feel like they're part of the church. That's good. That's positive. But people do not typically grow spiritually in small groups. So if that's your fallback answer, I suggest you get another one. You're going to need something, somebody who's going to know you, who's going to be in your face. Every disciple should be being discipled at all times. And so I'd recommend that maybe you get a spiritual director, maybe you get a coach, a mentor, somebody who's more spiritually mature than you are. Yes, put your ego aside and recognize that there are people who are more spiritually mature than you, and ask them if they would be willing to invest the time in your life so that you can get farther down that line. What about your family members? Where are they at with Christ? Apart from just going to church or maybe reading the Bible, that's good stuff. But is that enough? Is that the full indication of where they should be? If you are a leader in your family system, take greater responsibility for what's going on there. Let's talk about the time that you spend in personal growth. Can you increase the amount of time that you're devoting to your personal growth as a disciple? Let's look at the possibility of dissecting your life. There are different dimensions that you operate in your life. Can you look at each of those and try to figure out how could I be a more effective disciple in each of those different dimensions? Maybe you're really good in the church dimension. Maybe you're really good in the family dimension. What about at work? What about at play? What about in the wider community? You know, what about in the political arena? Do you even play in that arena? You should. All of us are called to. You know, so how are you doing that? Those are the kinds of things you might want to take a look at. Let's talk about public policy for a moment. Who do you talk about the issues of the day with? How effectively do you communicate a biblical worldview on those issues to that person without turning them off? Let's talk about voting. You have a responsibility to vote in every election that comes up. Why? Because every Christian is supposed to be influential in every sphere of life that we can be involved in. Politics is just one of those. It's not more important than any other, but it's equally as important as all the others. And so therefore, you need to be involved in that. Voting is the easiest way in terms of casting a ballot. It's not the easiest way in terms of casting a biblical ballot. And so make sure before you vote, you've really studied the issues. IFI puts out all kinds of information that helps break down the issues from a biblical point of view so that you understand that. Read those things. Understand them. You have questions? Talk to them. Communicate with them. They'll answer your questions. They live for that stuff. And so give them the opportunity. But you need to be involved in that.
When science needs no evidence. This is Ken Ham, an Aussie transplant with a passion for sharing the truth of God's word. In a millions of years worldview, comets are a big problem. You see, every time a comet orbits close to the sun, it gets smaller and eventually disintegrates. In just a few million years, there wouldn't be any comets left in our solar system. Yet there still are. To explain this, secular scientists propose the Oort cloud, where comets are supposedly produced before they're pulled into our solar system. But there's absolutely no observational evidence for this Oort cloud. When we start with God's word, we don't need to invent imaginary comet makers. God created the universe, including comets, just a few thousand years ago.
Discover more about our young universe when you visit our website at AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
This is an Illinois Family Institute, IllinoisFamily.org update.
In a new study published in a Nordic medical journal, researchers found that teenagers who undergo medical intervention to change their gender are much more likely to experience a steep decline in mental health. For example, researchers found that any psychiatric disorders patients experienced before the risky sex change surgeries and hormones, such as anxiety and depression, rose by 50% for boys and over 30% for girls. Researchers concluded that psychiatric needs do not subside after medical gender reassignment. Medical professionals across the country have often claimed that the only way to help children overcome gender confusion is to affirm their false beliefs. But this study shows that this claim is a dangerous lie that only increases psychological distress. It's time for the medical community in Illinois and across the country to stop these harmful practices once and for all. Go to IllinoisFamily.org to keep up to date on news items like this. That's IllinoisFamily.org.
What about children? Let's talk about the spiritual growth of children. Can you name for me one child whom you're discipling? If not, can you get on your knees and pray that God would identify for you one young person that you can begin to spend time with? Because in terms of the ultimate impact you'll have for the kingdom, your greatest impact is going to be with children. It's going to be a long, hard slog if you're trying to disciple adults who are not disciples already. And so, you know, if you can get to children, that's going to be a great thing. And each of us ought to be involved in that way. We can talk about having at least one evangelistic relationship. One person right now you know who doesn't know Christ, but whom you could introduce to Christ. Can you identify those people and be very specific about it? Be very intentional and strategic about it. And finally, is there a service project that you can engage in outside of your church that's going to make a difference in the lives of people? Because when we talk about modeling, among the people I'm finding in the research who have the greatest impact are the people who are out there serving others. Not just the people who are out there talking to others, but the people who are actually giving up their time, their energy, their skills to serve people. That's love in action. And that's what a disciple does. And so I'd ask you to look at each of those things, figure out what can you do. We are in the midst of a cultural collapse. But we can prevent that. We're the only ones who can prevent that. The Republicans can't prevent it. The Democrats can't prevent it. You know, Congress can't prevent it. It's God's disciples who can stop that collapse and restore the culture. It's one thing to stop it, but another thing to restore it. We have the goods to restore it. So I pray that you'll take that into consideration as well. And I think you had questions you wanted to bring up.
Thank you, Dr. Barna.
Sure.
We did get a flurry of questions at the last minute. So our first question. You say that after 13, it's almost a lost cause. How do we reset the bar and reach our kids and grandkids if we've missed that 13-year-old mark?
Okay, number one, is this on? Number one, I didn't say that it's a lost cause. I may be discouraging, but I'm not hopeless, okay? It's not a lost cause. It's just a much more difficult cause if you have to reach somebody after 13. So first part of the answer to that question, I guess, would be, well, if you're not a disciple, don't start discipling your children, okay? Because they're going to look at you, and they're going to say, who's he or she trying to fool? I know them. And so you really have to grind at your own spiritual development and get deeper, get to the point where you are overtly a disciple. They can see the transformation in you, and that's the thing that will compel them to listen to you, not the fact that you feel guilty that you didn't do what could have been done or maybe should have been done when they were young. But, you know, they've got to see that you know what you're talking about. You are what you're trying to create in them. And then when you get to that point, then I think the first thing you do is you admit to them, you know what? I spent 50, 60 years. I didn't get it. And finally God woke me up, and I've really committed myself to being a true follower of Christ. And it's taken this and that and this and that, and that's been a major shift in my life. Maybe you've seen some of that in my life. I hope so. So I'm not perfect. I'll never be perfect. That's why I need Christ. But I have changed. He has transformed me. And I want to share with you some of the important elements of that transformation, because I think they're critical for you as well. And then get going in a Socratic dialogue with them. That's where the process has to go. If you have that relationship and you've got that model, then engage in that dialogue.
All right, thank you. Are you encouraged by reports that say Gen Z is seeking truth, reading the Bible, and are more conservative?
I study Gen Z, and that's nonsense, okay? Seeking the truth. What does seeking the truth mean for Gen Z? It means they're going deeper inside themselves, to look inside themselves, to feel, is this really what I believe? They're not looking to the scriptures for truth. They're not trusting God to be and to provide truth. Most of them don't believe in the God of Israel. Most of them don't believe that the Bible is truth. Are there some in Gen Z that are moving toward the scriptures and toward God and toward Jesus? Yes, absolutely. Just like with every generation we've ever had in this country, there have been some people that have moved toward Christ, moved toward truth, etc. But, you know, these news reports, I mean, I'll tell you, I won't say it. We've just got to be real careful about what we believe from the media, okay? Because they'll get one piece of information and they'll run with it. I use data. Media use anecdotes. And so they'll find a person on the street wearing a Jesus shirt, and they'll go up to them and interview them and ask them, oh, what do you think? You know, you like the Bible? Oh, you go to church? Oh, you believe in Jesus? And suddenly a new trend has been born because that person on the street was interviewed. So you got to be very careful about this. Now, what's happened since COVID? What's happened, since Charlie Kirk's assassination? There was a big increase in church attendance And there was a big increase in Bible sales immediately after Charlie's murder. But we've seen that that has started to decline now. We have not seen that, and maybe it's too early to tell yet. That's possible. But we have not seen that there's been any impact in worldview in terms of the key beliefs, those shifting. So, you know, I'm going to reserve judgment on, you know, oh gosh, you know, Charlie's murder brought about revival. No, I don't think so. You know, but it did certainly bring about interest, and people were trying to figure out where can I satisfy this interest that I have, this curiosity that I've got, and we'll see what happens. Hopefully it'll wind up in a good place, but we'll have to wait to find out.
Thank you. What got you, this is a two-part question, what got you into research, and how easy and how do you find people to be part of your research?
What got me into research was I was managing political campaigns, and after a few campaigns, I realized I didn't want to manage political campaigns. Those of you who have done it know what this is. So there are about 16 different functions that a good campaign manager juggles at all times. And there were two that I was juggling that I really enjoyed. One was the polling, and the other was the speech writing, which was based on the polling. And so I thought, all right, well, let me see if I can go back to school, get some graduate degrees and that stuff. So I went back, got the grad degrees in research, and spent a lot of time writing and whatnot. So that's what got me into doing the research. I moved from New York out to California, worked with a big market research firm out there. They asked me to start a political division. So I did that, but a political research division. But then while I was there, I got hired away by a Christian media management company that was out here in Illinois, out in the Wheaton area at that time. And so that enabled me to take the same skills that I was using in the political arena and start using them for the cause of Christ. And so that was about 45 years ago. And so that's how I kind of got here.
Okay, and then the second part was, how do you find people to be part of your research?
There are two different ways that we do research these days. One is by using panels. The other is by doing random sample-based research. Panels, there's a whole science to putting together a viable panel. But those are people who agree to answer multiple surveys per year. And so they are not pristine research subjects. And in fact, the first thing that we do with them is we collect background information, so we don't have to do that in every survey. We can go back to that and put it into their answers for any given survey we do. But if you choose that panel properly and you don't abuse it, in other words, do too many surveys with those people, either over too long a period of time or too quickly right after each other, panels are viable, and you've got to rotate people off those panels constantly for them to remain healthy panels research-wise. The other way, random sample-based surveys, is where we have to go out and try to randomly identify people in the population and get them to answer the surveys. And you want to do that because in either of these cases, that random sampling aspect is critical toward being able to project the data to the wider population.
This next one, how do we wake up the church to raise up black robes in the pulpit?
There's no simple or quick answer to that. I think a lot of it comes back to disciples rising up and providing leadership in the church. Don't misunderstand the intent of what I'm about to say, but the research tells us that most pastors do not have a biblical worldview. Most pastors tell us that they do not believe they've been called and gifted by God to lead. they've been called and gifted to teach or preach or organize or counsel or other things, but not necessarily lead. And so when we talk about, you know, raising up a Black Robe Regiment or whatever, we're talking about the need for leaders, people who are sold out to Christ and are going to use their faith to and be used through their faith to transform the culture. So I think it comes back to disciples hearing the call of God to do what they need to do. I'm going to say something that I don't normally say in public. Listen, the local church, the way it exists today, doesn't exist in the Bible. So, you know, we treat it as if it's sacrosanct. It can't be changed. We have to have a paid pastor. We have to have a staff. We have to have a building. We have to have programs. We have to have all this nonsense that may be helpful. I'm not against the local church, but I want us to understand that the way it exists today, the way it's organized, works against disciples being free to do what they need to do to be agents of transformation for the kingdom of God. So that being the case, what I'm asking disciples to do is to just get with God. Don't worry about all the other stuff. Don't worry about people with titles and positions and influence and all that. You and God go one-on-one, and you figure out what is God calling you to do right now in the culture to transform it. He put you here. He raised you up. He's waiting for you to do it. Now, I know a lot of you, because you're here today, you're these kind of people. You're already doing some of this stuff. So I'm not jumping on you. But I am saying, you know what? Don't give up. If you're doing it, keep going. Keep going back to God. Keep asking, what else, Lord? What else do you want me to do? If you're not doing much, you're a little scared, you're thinking, well, maybe I could grow into that. Now's your time. Get on your knees. Spend days, hours, weeks asking the Lord, tell me. I will tell you, when I got into what I'm doing, it took me months on my face, on the floor. God, give me your vision. Give me your vision. I don't want to do anything but that. And that's what's enabled me for 40-some years to do it. It's not because I'm smart. It's not because I'm well-educated. It's not because I'm articulate. It's not because I'm white. It's not because I'm American. It's not because I grew up in New York City. If you have a problem with that, I want to talk to you afterwards, okay? Yeah. It's solely because I gave my life to God. I didn't just give my soul and say, yes, save me. You know, take away my sins. I want to live in your presence forever. Yes, I do. But that's not the sole reason why Jesus died. He died to give me a new identity, a new life, a new purpose. And so I need to get that from him. You need to get that from him in its totality and do it to the best of your ability until he gives you your final breath. There's no such thing as retirement for a Christian. In Hebrew, there isn't even a word for retire. And it's not part of the framework that we should be thinking about. We are here not to work forever, not to have fun forever. We are here to serve God forever. Do it as best you can.
Thank you for tuning in to Illinois Family Spotlight. I hope you enjoyed Dr. Barna's presentations as much as we did. And for more content like this, make sure you are subscribed to the Spotlight podcast and check back in for weekly releases. I personally am looking very much forward to the upcoming weeks of new episodes because we'll be talking with some Illinois political candidates because the general election is almost upon us. We'll be talking with some Christian entrepreneurs and some good friends of Spotlight to break down some very hard issues. I hope you tune back in, and until then, stay healthy, stay active, and God bless.
For more information about Illinois Family Spotlight, visit ifiaction.org. And to email questions and comments, do so at feedback@ifiaction.org.